How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. I'm also a certified genetic counselor practicing in the prenatal space. On this show, we explore genetics' impact on our health through conversations with leaders in genetics, experts like genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. My guest today is biotech titan, Dr. Stan Crook. He was the founder of Ionis Pharmaceuticals with extensive experience in the pharmaceutical industry, developing more than 20 marketed drugs. Recently, he founded another pharmaceutical company, Enlorum, which we are diving into on this episode as part of our Rare Disease Month celebration. So thank you so much, Dr. Crook, for coming on the show. I'm excited to talk about rare diseases today.
Well, I'm glad to be joining you. Thanks.
So I thought we could educate people that may not be familiar with rare diseases, that it affects less than 200,000 people in the U.S. But taking this a step further, what is an ultra-rare disease?
Well, there's no generally accepted definition, but at Enlorum, we define it as having 1 to 30 patients in the world who have precisely the same mutation.
And so this is much different than just like 1 in 200,000. You're talking about just a handful or 30 people in the world. So that is where we're setting the scene for an ultra-rare disease.
That's exactly right. And it is exactly the number that matters, because it's the numbers that cause the challenges that are unique to this patient group.
And what are some of those challenges in treating patients with ultra-rare diseases that have ultra-rare genetic mutations?
Well, of course, it all stems from the numbers. Typically, these mutations produce severe manifestations of the mutation, sometimes very rapidly fatal. And if a patient is lucky enough to survive, typically they'll spend many years seeking a diagnosis. And then if they're lucky, they'll get to a facility that can genetically characterize the mutation. And even in that case, then typically what they have to be told is there's no treatment, and it's very unlikely there ever will be a treatment. And it's that aspect of lack of treatment that Enlorum was founded to try to manage.
And for people to better understand, I mean, what is the standard process for drug development so that we can compare it to how yours differs so vastly?
The standard process for drug discovery and development, of course, is highly regulated. It requires a great many studies in animals and then numerous proofs of value in human beings. And a commercial entity also has to amortize all the failures against the few successes. And that's why the typical time for drug discovery to commercialization is more than 17 years. And the cost per drug that's successful is over $2 billion. Now, if you focus on rare diseases, again, the requirements are quite stringent still. And so typically it's going to be maybe 10 years and $1 to $500 million worth of investment. The problem with the ultra-rare patient is even meeting those requirements becomes impossible. How does one do a trial with a single patient and prove that benefit and risk are appropriate?
So there's certainly a lot of differences when we're comparing, you know, a more common condition where you have, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of patients that you can work with. But for this, the population is so small, and talking about just the cost of developing a drug, and you're saying it takes like 17 years on average to develop a drug. That is a long time, and just how much money has to go into this. So it's just remarkable what you're able to do for the rare disease community. I mean, tell people what Enlorum is about and how you differ from this standard drug development process.
Enlorum is a charitable foundation. It's actually not a pharmaceutical company. It's a charitable foundation. And I founded Enlorum to take advantage of the technology that we created at Ionis called Anisense technology. That technology is vastly more efficient than other drug discovery technologies, especially done at Ionis because we pioneered it. We have all sorts of systems that facilitate the identification of the right ASO. And so our process at Enlorum recognizes that we can't spend enormous amounts of time or money in animal studies, and it's essentially impossible to perform a clinical trial that would meet requirements for approval. And so we have no intention of trying to achieve a commercial approval, and our plan is to provide these experimental ASOs for life for free to these patients. And the reason we can do it is just the extraordinary efficiency and versatility of the technology that we created at Ionis. So Enlorum is basically a bridge from the need, which is the patient and a research investigator who's taking care of that patient and who has characterized the genetics of that patient, to the engine we built at Ionis, which then can, for some of these patients, create an ASO, manufacture it, and get it to them and provide that ASO for free for life. And so it is a remarkable new dimension to the idea of drug discovery and development. It's never even been dreamt of before. It's never been tried. But it's very clear that a commercial model can't meet the needs of these patients. Even if one could get approval for a patient population, say, of 10, the cost of doing that would mean that you'd have to charge these poor families tens of millions of dollars a year, probably. I think that's wrong, and I think it would also be very bad for our industry. And so Enlorum is designed to meet that very specific need in the patients that we can design ASOs to treat.
So let's talk about ASOs. What are ASOs and how are they different than other approaches to drug development?
Well, I'm sure your audience knows that genes are transcribed into RNA, and that RNA then is used to produce the proteins that do the work of the body. Most drug discovery technologies focus on making molecules that bind to proteins. Anisense technology takes an entirely new approach and designs small bits of gene-like material, heavily chemically modified so that they have good drug properties, to bind to target RNAs and cause that RNA to either be used more effectively to make more protein or to be degraded or prevented from making a disease-causing protein. What makes it so much more efficient is we know the rules. The very rules that are used by your body to manage genetic information are the rules that we follow when we want to design an ASO to take advantage of that target RNA.
So being able to take it so differently, as you were saying, a lot of drugs are targeting proteins to either fix them or make them work better, whereas this is kind of taking a step earlier in the process and saying, well, let's change those instructions and what's being used in the cell.
Exactly right. So you can think of it as we engage in altering the information management system of the cell, whereas the typical drugs try to alter the way work is done in the cell. And since we know the rules, then it becomes a much more efficient process for how to do that. And of course, I say that like it's simple. It's only taken 30 years and several billion dollars to get to this place.
Right. It wasn't like it was an overnight, oh, let's start this company. There's so much science behind that. So what do ASOs target in the body? We're talking about mRNA, but what are the specific organs that are targeted? Is it different for every type of drug? Are there similar organs that are usually targeted?
One of the beauties of the technology is that within a particular chemical class, all the agents are basically the same. They just differ in terms of genetic zip code, so that we can take tremendous advantage of that consistent performance. And with the medicines that we use, we know they distribute very broadly. They can be administered by essentially all routes of administration. including local for lung and local for eye, and of course intrathecally for administration of central nervous system disorders. So with NLORM, what we've done is focus on five organs where we really understand the performance of these medicines. We know the doses are low, we know the routes are correct, so that we can minimize the risk that the patient might be exposed to. And those are liver, kidney, lung, eye, and the central nervous system. The liver and kidney we administer subcutaneously, and the drugs distribute very broadly. And then in the eye, lung, and central nervous system, we administer locally, which makes it even safer.
So that you're only targeting the organs that you really need to for those certain disorders then. So, you know, we talked about NLORM taking a charitable approach to this, which is so different than what I hear from other companies of, you know, you're looking to raise money and then you're paying a pharmaceutical company to start developing and look at molecules that might work for a drug. I mean, this is so different and interesting. How can you, you know, fund all of this? Where is the money coming from? How is this a scalable approach?
Well, let's answer the last question first. It's very scalable. That is, if we have sufficient funds, the technology is versatile enough that we can treat many, many patients. We can't treat all. And obviously, our limitations today are these organs, and there are mutations that we can't address. So it is eminently scalable. And my focus is not on the patients we can't help. My focus is on helping the patients we can and changing the futures of these families, because they're really desperate. Now, the opportunity that we have really just began with the technology. And once I realized the technology could do this, then we had to put the rest of it together. The founding donors were Ionis Pharmaceuticals. Ionis has donated about $2.8 million. Biogen, our partner in the central nervous system, and in the same range, they don't want us to give specific numbers. And my wife and I have donated $3.2 million. And our plan this year was not to, that is 2020, was not to raise money, because I wanted to prove that the concept could work. But in fact, just word of mouth and interest, several other additional millions of dollars of new donations have come in. And we certainly have proven that the system can work in 2020. So we're very excited about the progress we made.
Yeah, that is remarkable just to hear, and just that you've given some of your own money to be having this as to start the company, and for all of these families that it's going to be impacting. I mean, that's just huge. I'm imagining all of the rare disease parents that are listening to this and just hearing that, you know, we always hear of, oh, there's new developments and new technology, but it's inspiring to hear that this is a specific one that's not just working for one rare disease, but you're focused on, you know, a variety of rare diseases that are in this ultra rare space.
Once you know the mutation, the name of the disease doesn't really matter.
That is
once
true.
You know the cause of a disease, now you have a name for that disease. It is mutation X cause problem. And that's very interesting. It's important to get people over that hump. We're agnostic as to the name of the disease once we know the mutation. And once we do that, then, of course, we can move rapidly. And so what we offer, which is very different, is immediate hope and very near-term treatment. Now, that treatment is experimental. And our job is to minimize the risk, make the risk prudent, while maximizing the benefit. And so we've put in important systems that assure high-quality decision-making, high-quality discovery of the right ASO, and high-quality development to that patient. And then finally, our intention is to evaluate the performance of these ASOs, and we've developed some novel systems to do that, and publish those results every year in summary, so that the world will have an opportunity to understand how much good we're doing, what the risks are, and what the challenges are. And there are certainly many challenges that we have to face.
Yeah. And just for people to know that you are a resource and for your name to get out there so that people can find you. So to understand the process a little bit more, How does it start? If there's, you know, rare disease parent listening to this and says, wow, this seems like it could be a fit. Like my child has a rare disease. We don't know exactly, or we found the mutation, but there isn't a treatment yet. What is that first step with starting this process?
Well, the first step is to go to the website with a research investigator who's caring for the patient. It requires both because we require a great deal of information. We need to know essentially a whole genome sequencing already done. We need to know the nature of the mutation. We need to know the function of the gene. That application then is completed. It's then blinded for patient confidentiality. And we evaluate it initially within NLARM, and then we present the case, typically with the investigator present, to a committee we call the Access to Treatment Committee. And that committee is made up of all the different types of expertise we feel we need to be sure that these decisions are well considered. If the committee agrees, then we move forward and we initiate discovery and development of the ASO at Ionis. In the meantime, well, that probably takes anywhere from 9 months to a year. During that time, we ask that the investigator and the patient document the disease thoroughly during that year so that we have a recent natural history to compare to when we add the treatment to it. And that's how we're going to evaluate these patients. So it's complex, as is necessary, and it does require that the patient be at a tertiary care center where there's a research investigator who's capable of genomic sequencing.
And so for parents that know of a couple other children that have the same disorder, so the same, you know, mutation, or that's the same gene that's involved, can they approach NLARM and say, you know, there's a small group of us with this disorder, can we all be treated together?
Yeah, let me just make an item very, very clear. Because a disease has the same name or even the same gene does not mean that the patient has the same mutation. So if the mutation is exactly the same, then we can use the same ASO that we used to treat that first patient. And in fact, we've already helped investigators get several ASOs to treat a group of patients that we now know is somewhat larger than we thought. And these are FUS mutation ALS patients. The FUS mutation ALS produces a very aggressive form of ALS. From symptom onset to death is on average about 6 months. And so that's an example of a single ASO being able to be used for a number of patients. Much more common is the mutation is actually unique to that patient. And in that case, every new mutation that comes our way requires a new discovery exercise. So the short answer, which I should have given you to begin with, is ask. Fill out the application and let us see what we can do.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a great example and, you know, encouraging to hear that, you know, for those cases, for those, you know, severe form of ALS, that you're able to develop an ASO and have something that is, you know, certainly helping with treatment there. Is there other conditions and disorders or other genes that you've been able to develop ASOs for within this new company or new organization, I should say?
Yeah, a foundation.
Foundation,
It's important to separate it from companies because we are charitable.
Certainly.
There are, and as you might imagine, a good many of the cases that we're receiving are from this have to do with central nervous system disorders, and a lot of them are mutations in channels, ion channels, and the ion channels, of course, manage electrical activity in your brain and your heart and everywhere else, and so many of these patients have epilepsy, severe, and then. Obviously, if that begins in infancy, they usually will have some sort of developmental delay. And so those are good examples of patients for whom we're making ASOs to treat right now. And then the FUS mutations are good examples of actually older patients that we've already helped get experimental ASOs. And I think suggestive information that they did receive benefit is already being developed.
Yeah, definitely. And you've had such an extensive career in the pharmaceutical industry. I'm just like, you know, before this, I was just reading about so much of what you've done. I mean, marketing 20 drugs, including Spinraza. Can you share about just that experience over the years and just seeing so many, you know, drugs come to market? And I'm sure there's a lot of other drugs that, you know, you were involved with that didn't quite make it to that point, because as we said, it's so involved and it takes a lot, you know, really put them through the ringer to end up being an FDA approved. I mean, can you share some of that experience of, you know, maybe with Spinraza?
Yes. Well, you know, I'm an MD PhD, and while I was finishing my training, I came to the conclusion that I could be the greatest scientist, educator of all times, and I couldn't possibly match the leverage that I would get from making one good new medicine. And that's why I went to the industry. I work for the patient. We are a special industry. Patients first. Investors make their money if we're successful. And I've been involved in a good many drugs that change the lives of patients. But Spinraza is a really special medicine. That comes along once in a lifetime. Here you have a disease, spinal muscular atrophy, where prior to Spinraza, no patient who ever had spinal muscular atrophy ever got better. The only course was down. And the most common form of the disease, the type 1, caused, on average, death in infants at 6 months, and they suffocate. Yeah. And Spinraza's changed all of that. We now know that if we treat patients before they become symptomatic, the vast majority of these patients grow and develop like normal, healthy children.
Which is remarkable.
It astonishes me, and I've been doing this for a lifetime. Yeah. And no significant side effects. And that technology, which allowed us to do that, is the technology that we have available to us at NLORM. And that's power. That's power for good. And I've had the opportunity to exercise it commercially. And now I have the extraordinary opportunity to exercise it in this charitable fashion. And for me, it's just the sort of the right way to take the next step in my long efforts in this area.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I just want to thank you on behalf of the rare disease community, because I think so many people are going to hear this interview and just, it's going to give them so much hope and just something to invest in and something to do, because, you know, from what I hear of rare disease parents and people in the community, that it can be really challenging to be on that diagnostic odyssey and getting an answer. And even when you get an answer, oftentimes there isn't a treatment, and you're able to say, you know what, let's change that, and let's change that for the ultra rare disease, you know, people and people that are affected by these conditions. So I just want to thank you so much for, you know, starting this, and it's very exciting. I'm really looking forward to seeing all of the new developments from this. Is there anything you'd like to leave with our audience today?
Well, first, thank you. One of my tasks right now is to make as many physician communities and patient communities aware of NLORM as possible. It feels terrible to imagine that there's a patient who we might help who goes unhelped because they don't know. So thank you for that. And I would just say that hope is a tremendously powerful asset to give patients and families hope, and then be able to deliver help to many of them is a joyous, wonderful experience, one that I wish everyone could have, but I'm lucky enough to have it. And so cross your fingers for us, and we've got plenty of challenges ahead, but I feel we're off to a great start, and look forward to telling you more about our progress in the coming years.
Yeah, definitely. And for people that are listening, do your part by sharing about N-Lorem. You can share this episode. We're going to have things on social media on our website, dnapodcast.com, and we're going to have links to nlorem.org and some more information there. But I think a way that for people that are involved in the rare disease community, I mean, social media and word of mouth, it has a huge impact. The rare disease community is very tight. So that is certainly a way that, you know, we can be contributing to your efforts and really passing that along. Is there any other websites to plug?
Oh, N-Lorem.
N-Lorem.org. I think that's like the big one, right?
That'll do the job. Just come see us.
And if you are listening to this on the podcast or radio, you can also check it out on YouTube. All of our 2021 episodes are available on there. And search social media for DNA Today. Again, we're going to be posting a lot of information about this episode, which you can share. And if you have any questions for myself or Dr. Crook, you can email into info@dnapodcast.com, and I'll make sure those are forwarded on appropriately. And I also just wanted to mention that later this month, UConn is hosting a podcast symposium. So be sure to check out our social media for more information on that. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Dr. Crook, again. It was such a pleasure to have you on, and for all of your years of experience. I mean, this could have been like a whole series. So, you know, just tip of the iceberg. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
All right, thanks for listening, and join us next time to learn, discover new advances in the world of genetics.
Genes of you and me, genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.